On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm delving into the archives and sharing with you an interview I've shared in the past, but it's a special one, folks. It's the interview I had the pleasure and honour of conducting back in 2009 with Liam Clancy, a renowned musician, personality, Irishman, New York American, regular visitor to America, North America. He lived in Canada for a while. Liam and the Clancy brothers set about in really changing aspects of the perception of Irish music and culture through their music. I had the great honour of interviewing him not long before his death in 2009 in New York City, actually in the Washington Square Hotel. So this is me speaking with Liam Clancy. Enjoy, folks. Today is March 29th, 2009, and I'm here in Washington Square Hotel with Mr. Liam Clancy. So, Liam, we were just talking there about that view of the immigrants. Can you just elaborate on what you were going to say?
The home that you leave when you emigrate becomes a snapshot, and it's frozen in time in your mind. Everybody I've ever known who goes back home says, you know, they can't believe it. Life has changed so much. I mean, did we expect it to stop still just because we left? But the changes have been immense at this stage. Certainly in the span of my lifetime. I was born in 1935, before the Second World War, which started in 1939. I was the last of a family of 13 originally. First two didn't survive. Well, one of them survived, but she was 21. And she died of, got tripped getting off a tram in Dublin. She was in the civil service. And TB, a gangrene or something, set into the quack doctor, set it wrong. I never even knew them, my two eldest sisters. I didn't know my brothers because they were in the war. And when I met him later, as adults, I met him here in New York.
I want to ask you a bit more about that, Liam, because you talk about it in the book, but I want to ask you a little bit more. They went to England, so initially, Tom and Paddy, they
went,
correct?
Yeah, they went to join the RAF.
And where did they join? In England somewhere?
I think so. You see, I was so young,
I didn't even know. Yeah.
I vaguely remember them. As a child, I remember more about the pigeons that they kept. And because they were bakers, all three of my brothers were bakers, which meant that they slept all day, and they got up at night and did the doughs to have them out for the morning, the bread out for the morning. And then they'd come home and they'd go to bed. And they kept pigeons up in the attic. And I would sneak up and there'd be three snoring bodies up in the beds in the attic. Woohoo, woohoo of the pigeons. So I knew the pigeons better than I knew my brothers.
When do you think that they left? Or do you know Liam? Did they leave?
They would have come back on leave, but very occasionally.
But do you think they left in like 39, 40, like early on in the war?
Must have been. Well, let's see now. I would have been four, so I probably wouldn't remember them then.
And did many fellas from Carrick, like their contemporaries?
Just about everyone.
Went off like that?
And like my brothers, they had some involvement in the IRA, and they went from the IRA to the RAF. So they were always involved with pieces of alphabet.
There's obviously no security clearance or anything in those days.
They fight for anybody.
Yeah.
As long as you can get out and have a bit of adventure. I think that's what it was all about. And then after the war, it was just so incredibly depressing. I remember years of just bad weather. My memories of those years were the sizzling of wet turf, wet logs, constant rain, depression, everybody leaving, no work, ration books, the slow reemergence of, I remember the first banana and the first orange that came back to town to a shop after the war. They were still, my sisters, five sisters and myself, in the house, all and my father and mother, of course, and sharing out the banana, dreaming of the time when I would actually get a whole banana or a whole orange for myself. That would be paradise. But we were so malnourished from the food in that whole period. That arm has been broken twice. That arm has been broken once. And I had TB. But it wasn't from major falls or anything. It just fell down and my bones were just snapped. Mm-hmm. You know, and we used to eat the wall. I think, I don't know if you remember that part of my book. My neighbor and I just thought that the wall up in the attic was so tasty. We'd get a knife and dig chunks out of it. Because it had been built for 300 years. It was 3 feet thick. Mm-hmm. And in those medieval times, they didn't build with concrete. They built with mortar, lime, sand, cow's blood, and horse hair. That's what bound the whole thing together. And obviously what we were getting is we were getting calcium out of the lime. We were getting some amount of protein out of the dried cow's blood. And the sand and the horse hair would be spitting out like this.
What age were you?
We must have been 9, 10, around that age. And then we lived off the land to a great extent, you know, taking mushrooms. I knew every edible thing that we were. People say hunter-gatherers went out, you know, thousands of years ago. We were hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. We had snares for rabbits. In season, early in summer, we off up to the woods to pick freckhorns, as we call them, blueberries. Mm-hmm. And then everything in season coming along, the turnips, you go into the field and you get a sharp stone and you'd cut the turnip open, you'd make a meal out of that. You wouldn't dream of going home. There was nothing at home to eat anyway. The autumn would start coming along and you start getting the mushrooms. And then the blackberries, hawthorns, and hawthorn leaves, which were called bread and cheese and charlie. And in the fields you got sallygrass, which is sorrel. So we knew everything that you could eat, and then we used to, in the small streams, we used to tickle trout. You know, you'd go in under the bank and pretend your hand was like a floating piece of leaf or something like that. Right. And you'd feel the trout, and once you get to the gills, chip, snip, and pull them out, catching a dozen trout one day. My mother couldn't believe it. Some Americans visiting, they were in utter amazement at my pulling the fish out of the stream.
Tom and Paddy came over here then, like, what, 46 or 47, was it?
Yeah. They had to go to a colony. They got demob money, is what it was called. They had an option to go to Australia or any of the British colonies. They wanted to get into America, and the closest place was Canada. So they went to Toronto, and they worked there for a while, Massey Harris. And we had an aunt out in Cleveland, Ohio, so she claimed them in. So you had to have a relative claim you in. Mm-hmm. So they went to Cleveland, Ohio. Paddy worked as a taxi driver. Tom worked in the playhouse there, Cleveland Playhouse. Yeah, with Cleveland.
And he, like, acting?
Yeah.
He got an acting job right away?
Yeah, He'd come back briefly to Ireland and got into a touring acting company, first with Andy McMaster, who was a famous actor manager, did Shakespeare and so on. Phillips, different town every night, you know. And then he joined a company called with the grand name of Shakespeareana International. An actor manager named Jeffrey Kendall, and he had a troupe of actors who probably couldn't get work in London. They just weren't good enough. They were third string, fourth string actors, and they would do Shakespeare. They made a film about them actually called Shakespeare Walla. In the winter they would tour India, and the summer they would tour the provinces of England and tour Ireland. So he worked with them for a while.
So how long did they stay in Cleveland, Solene?
They stayed in Cleveland until they made the connections, I don't know how, with the people in New York. And then, as I was telling you last night, they had an old jalopy which they decided to pack up everything in Cleveland, drive into New York. And the car got as far as the swamps of New Jersey, died on the side of the road, so they pushed it in, let the swamp swallow it. And they were right near a brewery, so they walked to the brewery and got a job there and made enough money to eventually move into New York.
And you don't know who the connection was, say, here within, like, the village?
What
interests me, Liam, is the fact is that
we did have a cousin who, I believe, he was a New York policeman who, hush hush, heard from Paddy later, was one of the most corrupt cops New York ever knew. Mm. Yeah.
Do you think they were in contact with him? What I'm just interested in is, like, for two fellas from Ireland to end up even in the 60s where they did, I mean, if they had ended up in the Bronx or in Woodside in Queens or something, it would have been more normal, you know, in a way. I was just interested.
It would have been more normal. But it was the theatrical background that brought him to the village.
Yeah.
And in scouting around looking for work, they would have come across the beginnings of off-Broadway theatre.
Yeah.
And they ended up taking a lease on the Cherry Lane Theatre and forming a company called Trio Productions.
Like, it's an unusual story that in and of itself. Do you think that, you know, you describe your parents as being very kind of theatrical or, you know, interested? They were
professionally by
but,
any
but
means.
Yeah, yeah, but in their
but
own
that was
setting.
Their bent, yeah, they certainly were. My father loved to recite, you know, very emotional, involved, loved the stories of all the Italian operas and would tell us all the plots and sing the arias, and, which frightened the life out of his son. On a Saturday night when he'd be mending the shoes, he'd have the basin of hot water, and he had worked in the tannery as a bookkeeper. The tannery closed down in 1917 because they raised the red flag and declared themselves Soviet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, smacks of the Skibbereen Eagle as his eye on Russia. They were all thrown out of work, and he tried various things. But the factory, the tannery opened again, and he used to get big raw lumps of leather, you know, and he made our shoes and mended our shoes. He would do all this on a Saturday night, try and have things ready for Sunday mass, and he'd have the leather steeping, you know, and he'd have the last, and he'd be pounding the leather out, and he'd be doing the anvil chorus, you know. and that's difficult to do with a mouthful of tack. Like, they were always waiting for him to inhale at the wrong time and swallow the tack. most of his family had emigrated to Wales. He had been brought up on the Bessborough estate, which had been an old Norman Celtic Norman Gaelic aristocracy. Thousands of acres belonged to the Daltons. You see, first the Normans came in the 1100s, set up the town of Carrickonshire, or Carrickmacgriffin as it was called, and they walled it in, and they made war with the it would be the Butlers, the Powers, and they made war, of course, with the locals, who would be the McGraths, I mean my mother's people, mm-hmm. and then started to trade with them. After they built up the fortifications, the town became known as Carrickmacgriffin, and they started trading with the locals and learned Irish. It was mostly Irish speaking at the time. They brought in a lawyer from Cashel named Donald Clancy, who in turn had come from Clare. And he was versed in the Brehon laws and in the newfangled Norman laws. And they needed someone to be an intermediary. Yeah. And I just found an old history of our hometown of Carrick. In return for his services in 13-something, Donald Clancy was given a tract of land called Craig, outside Carrickmacgriffin, Carrickonshire as it is now. When we were growing up, we always gravitated to this place. There was a river there, there was weirs there, and it was a beautiful piece of the part of the country. But it was belonged to an Anglo Irish family, mm-hmm. of the Beeries. They were a good family, they were a nice family, but they were, of course, upper crust. They trained horses for the Aga Khan, as a matter of fact. But they died off. There was only one old maid left there, Pearl Berry. And even in the end of her days, she wasn't able to ride she wasn't able to tackle the pony and trap. So she would come into the town on a bicycle, which didn't have a brake, and poor thing, it was sad. But the family, the place was sold off, a couple of 100 acres. And Paddy, as a young man, very young man, like 4 or 5 years of age, he'd get his stick. First Monday of every month, my mother used to describe him going down to the fair. It was the fair day in Carrick, and he'd say, "I must go down and see my men and my cattle." They were all his. And his great ambition from word go was to own Craig, not knowing that it had been in the family since the 1300s. Yeah. And I have a son now named Donald Sassy, and his cousins live in Craig. It's funny the way the world goes around. Yeah, the salmon comes back to spawn.
Uh-huh. What was the Wales connection, Liam, with your father's family? Where in Wales were they? And
what happened was Cromwell swung through our place, and of course it was to hell or to comet. And he, by just conquest, decided all the lands, the good lands, were going to be his. He had to be out by May 5th, whatever it was, 1625, was it? Something around there. And he had to be either west of the Shannon or behind. Your land was forfeited.
And some of the Clancys went to Wales at that point in time?
No, what happened was, because the Clancys were lawyers and bards from Clare originally, and then coming over east, over to Cashel, they were always involved in one way or another with the big house. And there are lots of Clancy's are buried around, I feel, a lot of graves around Kilcash, which would have been one of the Butler, one of the important Butler castles. And they were on Divan, Lady Iva. She was a great patroness of the Gaelic cause and the Catholic faith and the Irish language, of course. And she seems, I would reckon that she sheltered a lot of the, or at Kilcash, a lot of the defeated army of Kinsale were sheltered there, must have been sheltered there on the way back. That's right under, on the way back from the Battle of Kinsale. Mm-hmm. Because right under the castle there's Ballynail, the town of the O'Neills. O'Donnells became locally known as Daniels, and they'd be cousins of ours as well. Now, they're two Donegal tribes. The only way I can figure that they would be there, with townlands named after them, would be that they were the retreating armies who didn't get further north than Carrick. And they would probably be going to sympathetic houses where they would, you know, be fed and taken care of for a while until they got on the road again. That's the way I reckon. Then the town had, our town had undergone wave after wave of invasion and slaughter.
Yeah. Especially with its location, it was...
Well, you see, it was the easiest gateway from England into the heartland of the Golden Vale. After all, the whole valley of the River Shure is still to this day known as the Golden Vale, land of milk and honey. And it was prize land. Mm-hmm. So they all came up there. The Normans came up there. Cromwell, well, he swung south after Drogheda, after the slaughtering Drogheda. He sacked the town. They still to this day say, there's a saying in Carrick, Carrick, I dread you. Clonmel, I hate you. And they were supposed to be the words of Cromwell. He had such trouble with taking the towns of Carrick and Clonmel. Yeah. And his notion was to go over it, to take his army over as far as Limerick. And the weather, I think, beat him on that one, and he decided to leave it for another year, came back and bivouacked his army. He did keep going. It was in the next wave of invasion, which would have been William of Orange after the Battle of the Boyne. He swung south, the same route as Cromwell. The weather turned against him. He decided he couldn't make it over to Limerick. So he bivouacked his army, wintered outside the walls of Carrick. Then would have sailed down the River Shure and back to England to come back another time. He left quite a mark on Carrick. For instance, up against the walls were built these, you know, probably lean-tos at the time, and then maybe added to a little bit. And those little streets became one of the streets that I was born in, which is called William Street, after William of Orange. And my next-door neighbour, his name was Ned Orange.
Mm-hmm. And was that the house that you grew up in, Liam, the house that your father grown up in?
No, my father had grown up in Bessborough.
Oh, yeah, you said that.
Which was the estate, the Cromwellian estate, which had been given to one of Cromwell's generals called Ponsonby. That was going to be a... settled peacefully by Ponsonby, the general, marrying the Dalton girl, mm-hmm. whose property they were taking. And that was a negotiated settlement. He went back to England, and she bought her trousseau, And he went back to get the titles of the land from London, from the Queen, I suppose. While he was there, he married his old sweetheart, Elizabeth, and came back as a married man with his wife, Beth.
And took the land anyway.
Took the land anyway, and the Dalton girl drowned herself in the Pill River, and he renamed the estate Piltown, or Bessborough, in the village of Piltown.
Was your father from a big family?
No, what happened then was that stayed on in from being bards and lawyers. The family kind of stayed with the aristocracy, but now became, my grandfather was the gamekeeper, the head gamekeeper. The old Lord Bessborough died. Young lad, his son, took over. What would happen at that time, even the old Lord Bessborough stayed, what would happen is that they would get an overpopulation of males. Mm-hmm. They'd want to get rid of them. So he would write a letter. He was a heavy shareholder in the English railways, which were now starting up. So he would give this letter of recommendation, and they would go over to Wales, where they would present this letter, and got work straight away in the new industrializing England and Wales, of course. So there's a huge population of Clancys in Wales.
Who would have originated from around there,
yeah.
From your family?
Yeah. My father was actually born on another estate up in, not that far away, in Castlecomer, where there was another big Cromwellian estate. And his father married a woman named Sinnott from Carnew in Wexford. So my father and mother spent their honeymoon down in near Gorey, what do you call it, Cortown. Of course, after that, the young Lord Bessborough took over, and he despised Catholics. So he said, you either convert or you leave. So he threw all the Catholics off the estate.
This was in your father's lifetime? Or your grandfather?
My grandfather.
Right.
So he had to move the family into Carrigachure. There was a beautiful park there. And the old caretaker of the park had died, so my grandfather got the job. Since he was, you know, he knew all about trees. And it's still a beautiful park. Until very recently, I had two of the most magnificent specimens of redwoods in Ireland, California redwoods. Yeah. Sequoia gigantea. There's only one of them left now. When I was there last, but still has beautiful trees. And he lived in a cottage there. That's how they came to be in that place.
And he was married to the Sinnott woman originally from Carnew, your grandfather, is that right?
My grandfather, yeah. Now, it was either he or his father had farmed someplace outside Carriganshore in the County Kilkenny again, and he had 12 children, but started to have an affair with the milkmaid. The priest heard about it, came out to tackle him on it, and was driven off by my great-grandfather, I think it was, with a pitchfork. And he then emigrated to America, to Florida, I believe, where he married again. He was a bigamist. Had 13 children with her. His sons from that marriage struck it rich in the gold rush in Australia, in California. And years later, I remember the all very hush-hush when I was a child. I didn't understand it, but the state of California were trying to track down the relatives. And they tracked down my father in Carrick and Shure. He denied any knowledge or any relationship. So they moved on, and the Clancys in Wales got whatever was gone. Except my father did end up with a gold watch, much to his embarrassment. And even more to his embarrassment, one of the daughters came back to find her father's place. She was from New York. Her name is Margaret. And she went to Piltown. She was obviously quite wealthy. And to this day, there is this beautiful stained glass window, Margaret Clancy of New York, in memory of my grandfather. So you can imagine the skeletons in the closet there.
Yeah, people didn't like talking about those things years ago. You give up your job working in Dublin, you come back to Carrick, and you're doing a lot of acting stuff and everything locally.
Started, yeah.
Did you always plan on coming over here, Liam, when you were...
Well, I really wanted to come out.
Or was Diane Hamilton the catalyst?
She was the catalyst eventually, but I think I would have come out anyway. Because of the glowing stories coming back from... you see, my brother Bobby used to come back regularly. And he'd bring back tape recordings from Grange Village and the parties and the sessions, you know.
So he'd followed Paddy and Tom over here to New York, is that how it worked out?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember him leaving, Bobby leaving? Were you old enough to remember that?
I don't remember him leaving. Well, he went to the RAF as well.
Oh, that's right.
And he went straight from there to Toronto as well.
Okay.
To meet up with Paddy and Tom. He didn't go to Cleveland, but came straight down to... He and his buddies, Noel Powers, they came down... I guess at that stage, they came down to work with Paddy and Tom, who were working in the brewery.
Do you know where in Jersey that was?
I've passed it. I smelled it. I think it was... Ballantyne. They made Ballantyne Ale or something. But anyway, they worked on everything. They were young, and Bobby got a terrible lung problem. I think they were knocking down a place that had asbestos or something, and they were told to wear these masks. But they couldn't work if they didn't sing, and they couldn't sing if they had masks on. Mm-hmm. So I threw these things away. Came at them later. Well, Bobby came back full of American pizzazz, you know, and big suits, flashy. Everything was so small. He was really young. But Bobby hated work. As he used to say himself, I'm a bit heavy for light work and I'm a bit light for heavy work. And I was running my father's insurance business. My father had built up this business without any knowledge of how you build a business. So he had a big round table and was mound of, you know, papers on it like that. And a farmer would come in who was about the insurance for the bull or something like that. My father would put his hand into this pile of things and magically pull out the policy belonging to John Comerford, you know. Mm-hmm. And he wanted me to go to Dublin to learn how to organize a business. So I learned all about cross-filing and, you know, the numbers and names, the policies and all that. And from the day I came back and set the thing up, he started going into decline, because it was a total mystery to him. It was like new technology. Mm-hmm. But Bobby came back, and Esau, this is fantastic business, you know. You make money for nothing. The people just come in, they. So he said, how would you like to watch in New York in my place? And all I wanted was the wind of the word. At that point, Ian Hamilton was, we had finished making those tapes, and she was intent on my marrying her, but also wanting to set up a record company. She came back one Christmas and she had a ticket on the SS Ivernia to sail across to New York for January.
January 56.
And it was only for a year to go on, you know. So my mother was distraught because I was the last of the family. But it was only for a year, supposedly. But at the end of that time, I came back, and I'll never forget the. We were going into the winter. The town was deserted. Every young person had left to England or to America, mostly to England. Ireland was going through a huge youth. I have to laugh when I hear him calling this a depression, you know. We live in High on the Hog, and all the restaurants full, and it's just laughable to call it a depression.
In comparison with
depression. I've seen depression.
Did you ever think of going to England, Liam? As you say, a lot of people went there.
You see, if you went to England, you were a paddy, you were a navvy. You were the equivalent of the Mexican illegal going in, treated like dirt. You came to America as an Irishman. Hey, from Ireland, the old song. Because they blazed the way here, you know. So you were somebody if you came here. And of course, my arrival here was so totally different, even from the people who arrived in their droves from Ireland at the time. They would have come over, say, by a plane. They would have gone to one of the Irish ghettos, a Yonkers or the Bronx or Far Rockaway or whatever. And they would never have moved out of those areas, you know. You wouldn't hear anything but an Irish accent. They had their dance halls. They tried to meet someone, preferably from their hometown, if not from their home county, marry them, and continue that, you know, blinkered ghetto mentality. I was brought here by a Guggenheim, brought up to see her uncle's museum, Solomon Guggenheim Museum, under construction. I was fascinated with. I had studied art in Dublin, so I was into architecture, into plays, into staging, building scenery, designing scenery, acting. So it was paradise for me, you know, to come into that kind of America.
I suppose more so your brothers, because they came ahead of you. Like, were they actively rejecting that ghetto, or
no, they were just too engrossed
in what they wanted
in
to
theater,
do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what did you think of that whole scene of the dance halls and the Gaelic Park and all that?
Well, I never saw them until we started playing in them, and then I realized there was a whole other culture, that Irish American culture, which I was never aware of. I had seen the movies, you know. Pat O'Brien and Bing Crosby and Tour and Your Mother Come From Ireland and all that. One of the first people we met, actually, when we started on the Ed Sullivan Show, we met was Pat O'Brien. We became quite good friends. We visited his home in Hollywood. He was very gracious to us. It was very different type. We were a very different type of immigrant from the
yeah, no, even your
mass exodus.
People who were coming over in that 10-year period, say, between the time Paddy and Tom came here and even when you came 10 years later or so, I mean, as you say, there were droves of people around the same age as you who went, they almost exclusively went into those pockets of Irishness and stayed with their own. That's why I'm so fascinated by that. that link here is so interesting because it's so different. One thing, yeah, I want to ask you was, like you touched on those people, predominantly they wanted to meet partners, definitely usually from Ireland and from the county or from their own parish or town or whatever. And here you are in the village drinking and playing music and hanging out with black people, Jews, yeah, as you say, communists, whatever. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? Because that was unusual as well.
Well,
vis-a-vis the Irish-American community.
It didn't seem unusual to me because it was the only America that I knew. And I had been acting in Dublin as well. So I was kind of on the wavelength of the artistic. Mm-hmm. And I knew that it was a different culture, different people you met. And almost straight after I got here, my brother Tom had been working. He had done a season at the Poets Theatre at Harvard University. A woman named Mary Manning, Molly Howe, as she called me, she was called. She was an old Abbey actress. She'd married a man named Mark de Wolf Howe in Cambridge and set up the Poets Theatre at Harvard. And she was doing a series of productions of Yeats plays. And she called on Tom. Tom lied through his teeth. Well, he was working. He was working on Broadway with Orson Welles at the time in King Lear. And he said he couldn't go, but he said, look, my brother just arrived. And he's been playing at the Abbey, and he started his own theatre. Lied through his... Now, I had started my own theatre. And I had, you know, directed, but I'd never been inside the Abbey. The Abbey had burned down. But anyway, can he be on the next plane? So I went up, you know, to and I was met by the director, who was the nicest person you could meet, but, you know, as bent as a $2 bill, and thought that I would be a very, very cultured actor, you know, from Dublin, and had arranged for tickets for the symphony for the night I arrived at Symphony Hall. You know, it was years later before I discovered South Boston. And the ghettoization of Boston, which was even more extreme. Mm-hmm. What did strike me was when I went to Boston, I stayed at Michael Lindenthal's house. He was the director, with his father and mother, fortunately, were there. Because I didn't know anything about homosexuals or anything like that. But he wasn't aggressively so. You know, if you were straight, he didn't bother you. But he did come home a few nights with cuts and bruises. And when he would go down to the docks and put the make on some sailors who would beat the hell out of him and things like that. What was I going to tell you about? Oh, yes, they had a housekeeper who I was able to speak to in Irish. She was from Connemara. Had very little English. But, you know, was very much stayed in the background. So I began to see then the two kinds of Irish immigration.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when it first struck you as to how kind of insular and homogenous the Irish community was here? I think you've kind of pointed out that Irish America wasn't that delighted with your kind of very open outlook in terms of politics.
Initially, they were frightened of it. They couldn't figure it out. It wasn't anything Irish. It wasn't anything they'd ever heard or seen, because they only knew the Hollywood Irish. And we were, you know, when we first started getting acting jobs, if you got an Irish part, or if you're doing a television show and playing some kind of an Irish part, they say, could you kind of beef up your Irish accent, you know? They wanted us to conform to the stage Irish, which had, I suppose, had evolved out of... Mick Maloney is an authority on vaudeville.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the
and the number of families, you know, Irish families and black families who all worked the vaudeville circuit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the integration that happened there in words, like the word so long is Irish slán, you know, health, bye, goodbye. The word jazz is in Gaelic chas, is heat, was a euphemism for sex. So, you know, the people have been looking for the origin of the word jazz for years. It's an old Irish. And so many words, somebody has been tracing them recently, but, and then you look at Sammy Davis Jr. or some of these, you know, shuffles, and they were very much started out as little riffs of imitations from Irish dancing, from the people who were thrown together in the vaudeville circuits. I remember doing a concert out in the Midwest somewhere, and there was an MC for the night. Very familiar to me. I couldn't pinpoint, you know. And he went out and he introduced us. During the intermission, we got talking. And the name didn't ring a bell, but it was Kelly. And he said, started talking about the vaudeville days, and turned out he was Gene Kelly's older brother, you know, singing in the rain. Fascinating talk we had afterwards, telling us, you know, that from the time you were a tot, when you were in vaudeville, you had to learn a routine. You had to earn your keep, no matter how small you were. And the dance routines were drummed into you. And the more things you could do, the more versatile you were, you know, the better. Because somebody might get sick, you'd have to fill in. Somebody who did a dance routine, if they got hurt or something, even though you were the singer or the whatever, or the magician, you had to jump in, you had to do the dance routine. But the story of that family were fascinating before they made it into the big time. But I recognized him. You know, if you'd put a toupee on him, you would have said it's Gene Kelly.
When you were performing in going around America and stuff like that, Liam, were there particular audiences? Did you prefer like a predominantly Irish audience, or did you prefer a more American one, or was there any difference?
Preferred an enthusiastic audience.
Whatever way, yeah.
People who would sing along, or people who understood it. You know, you could tell by what people requested to a great extent where their heads were at. It was great performing in the theatres and so on, but when it got to a point where pub clubs began offering more money because they could make more money because they were serving drink and all that, and that became a much more rowdier, and we were under contract to the Playboy clubs for a couple of years, and we eventually bought our way out of that contract. 5 shows a night, 15 minutes each. You couldn't capture an audience. You couldn't make a show, you know. You got out there and you trotted out 5 songs, whatever, and you got off the stage to vulgar old men smoking big cigars, grabbing bunnies' bums, you know. That was the size of it. It was disgusting, to be honest with you. And we got to know a lot of the girls who were, and this tragedies, the falseness of the whole thing, the facade, mask. Most of those girls who worked as bunnies were there out of desperation. Remember that beautiful Chinese American girl? She had 2 or 3 little kids, discovered she had breast cancer, and the only way that she could make money fast enough to have an operation was to become a bunny, and allowed herself to be grabbed every night, and blah blah blah. It was whole thing was one tragic story, I thought.
Oh, I just want to ask you, you know, you talked about last night the jumpers, the ones that your mother had knit, yeah. You know, like people, you know, read into like the significance of that, and I liked the way you talked about it was a very practical thing your mother had sent them over, or had them knit and whatever. But the Jewish guy, the manager guy who kind of saw them and liked them.
Zeroed in straight away.
Do you think that part of that was maybe like his interpretation of what Irish guys should look like in terms of not stage Irishness maybe to the full extent, but...
Well, it was more that it was the Kingston Trio were wearing the striped, you know, the short-sleeved Bahamian, you know. When I go down to Bimini, never get a lick until I go down to Bimini. That collegiate look of spring break and all that. He didn't know what something that was authentically Irish and yet was a uniform, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the Irish sweater and knit the bill, just fit the bill, knit mm-hmm. the bill. It was amazing what happened after that. Within 6 months of that first appearance on Ed Sullivan's show, the sale of iron sweaters jumped in America by 700%. I got a letter not that long ago from a man who was about to leave Donegal at the time. His long letter, I wish I could find it. He was emigrating because there was nothing for him. And his heart was broken because he was in love with this girl. Their plan was to get married and have a family. And he had his ticket bought and everything arranged, the people he was going to, Boston or wherever. And the whole thing with the Clancy Brothers hit. And we were on television and we were on radio constantly. And the demand for iron sweaters went through the roof. He tore up the ticket, he said. He started a small factory, got all his family knitting, became a huge business. And he said, would you believe, he said, I married the girl I loved, I have 12 children, and a happy man today with my grandchildren. And he says, all thanks to you and the sweater.
From 61, you kind of, sorry now for my ignorance, after the book I'm kind of not as familiar with what happened, but for about 10 years it was like basically touring all around the place, and you kind of described the kind of craziness of it and whatever. Did you ever consider America home, Liam? Did you, or was your aspiration always to go back to Ireland?
One of the fortunate things that had happened with flight becoming much more popular, you know. First time I came by ship.
Yeah.
But that you could go back and forth.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long, you know. I came in 1956. By 1963, I had been home multiple times. What we would do is take off every summer and go home.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an arrangement with a friend of mine who owned a garage. That I would buy a car for £100 at the beginning of the summer. Sell it back to him for 80 at the end of the summer. So I had a car for a whole summer for 20 quid. You know, I would just go wherever the car would take me, put the guitar in the back, and it would want that. And the tape recorder. I had an Agra, which we, when we disbanded, or when Paddy sold the record company, I inherited the Agra, which was a great machine, still used in movie making. You know, it's one of the greatest little portable machines
like
ever made.
Like a reel-to-reel one?
Reel-to-reel, yeah. Handmade in Switzerland. And I took that everywhere. And that's when I started recording people like Seamus Ennis and Joe Heaney. And I continued the tradition of recording just everything all the time. I have hundreds of hours.
Mm-hmm.
But... You see, we had to get songs. We had to get a new batch of songs all the time because we knew that in November the Carnegie Hall concert would be coming up and then the tour and then we'd break for Christmas, but the March tour would be coming up. So we had to keep getting new material. And there was cross-pollination all the time. I'd be back and forth to Ireland and England. And we used to meet up with people like Ewan McCall and get songs from him. And Luke Kelly had come back and they joined a group in Dublin who were known as the Heads. When they went to get a name, Luke was reading Joyce's The Dubliners, and he said, "There's a name for you, The Dubliners." And Luke brought back a great store of songs from England. He'd been living up in Newcastle on Tyne.
And were they English songs then, or were they?
Oh, well, one of our big songs, a song that I got from Luke, and it's "No, Nay, Never, No, Nay, Never, No More," was an Australian song that he learned in Newcastle on Tyne. And he learned it as, "Now, now, never, never no more will I ply the war-rover, never no more." But of course, by the time we were finished with it, it became the best known Irish song on the planet.
Closing out today's show, folks, my interview from 2009 with Liam Clancy of the Clancy Brothers fame. A real honour to share it with you on today's This Irish American Life, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did recording with him. Ar Eisteig, Roimhe Thanaim Dhíolais.